Welcome to Shooting the Breeze, brought to you by the team at Franktown Firearms, a family-owned, family-friendly shooting range in Franktown, Colorado. Franktown Firearms offers practical, defensive training, as well as an impressive selection of firearms at the lowest tax rate, so you can develop confidence with your firearm. The team at Franktown Firearms believes the only difference between a beginner and an expert is practice, so they equip you to keep yourself and your family safe in a welcoming atmosphere. And now, here are your hosts of Shooting the Breeze.
Howdy, howdy, everyone. Welcome back to Shooting the Breeze with Franktown Firearms. We're your hosts. I'm Sean Steven.
And I'm Karen Murray.
And Karen Murray, who has been so kind as to let me hijack the show that she hosts every week.
No. Your show. It's your show. I just sit in.
You do more than that, but you're being modest. But this is a part three of a three-part series that I wanted to do. We've been covering a lot with Israel and what happened over there on the October 7th attacks and since. And it's been great. The responses we're getting are great. It's been shared around the world many times. We are bringing up these. We have been asked a lot to allow for people to listen to these shows. So if you are listening now and you haven't heard last Monday or the Monday before that, you can go to franktownfirearms.com, click on our menu there, and click on Shooting the Breeze, and you will have a streaming link if you would like to listen to this show. We'll have live later today. My partner Mike will do that, and we've got the last two, as well as I think he's starting to put the archives from all of our shows. So we cover a lot of ground.
That's great.
And yeah, it's been great. We have our guests with us, too, today. Alan is back from our store. Alan, welcome back.
Hi, guys.
And we have also my friend Dan. And they're going to be covering a lot of, they have a lot of knowledge from overseas. And we're trying to, cover a lot of topics, cover a lot of ground. And it's been some really awesome knowledge to get, because we're all having, certain things force-fed to us through the media mainstream, and we're trying to take that further, and we've had guests on the last couple weeks. And Dan, I'm really glad that you're here to join us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you for being here. So we'll just jump right in. Something that we were talking about since our last show that was extremely interesting to me on how things are over there, and you kind of compare it, for folks listening. We live here, and of course, I might be just a scotch bias having a gun store and range that is, your family-friendly neighborhood gun dealers.
Conveniently located.
Yes, of course, right at the intersection of Highway 86 and Parker Road in Franktown 7 days a week. But just not really
shameless
biased,
plug.
Though, But we were covering, and something that I was learning a lot of that kind of stuck out to me was how gun ownership is viewed and exercised in Israel and in the, some of the areas around them. You have a very stark difference, not only in government, but in personal liberty and also how that liberty is viewed. And it kind of made me start thinking and, talking with Dan and Alan, starting to see is like where I just want to judge and be like, well, that's just because they don't have the freedom to do it. And that's why but it's also kind of made it apparent to me that how it's viewed over there, if something's viewed differently and culturally different, I'm looking at it from my cultural view, where it's like, my kids are starting to shoot at 2 years old if I can get them to pay attention and sit on my lap with a single shot 22 or something, or even a BB gun. But it's just, if it's not important as much over there. And not saying that it's viewed as not important, but just differently. And so something that was interesting to me was I was learning that, for example, in Israel, you have to be a certain rank in the reserves to be carrying a handgun. And it's very rare. It's not something that you would normally see, like where here, anyone can go as long as they don't have a criminal record that prohibits them. They can go get their concealed permit. They can carry their handgun to defend themselves and their families. And it's viewed as everybody's right, regardless of anything else. And over there in Israel, it's you have to have a certain rank and have a reason for it, and most people aren't caring. Is that correct, Dan?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there's a few categories of types of categories of people who can apply for a permit to carry, and we can kind of quickly go over that. But for the most part, it's based on, you know, as a lot of people know, most people serve in the military there. They have regular service that lasts between 2 to 3, between 2 to 3 years.
Is that men and women?
Yes. And then, and it changes with the times. I mean, anyway, let's call it between 2 to 3 years. And then a lot of people stay in their units or other units as reservists. And depending on, it used to be kind of depending on rank, then was it was kind of expanded a little bit, not just rank, but actually whether or not you have handgun training from the military, because not every soldier, you know, uses a handgun. So if you have handgun training, either because of the unit or because of your rank, essentially all this is if you think of it, it's a selection and training and recertification and qualification process that is done by the military for its own purposes. But then the kind of civilian authorities of public safety or public security can say, well, wait a second, we do have active shooters happening throughout the country. So these are spontaneous attacks that happen in public. So we need to come up with a spontaneous response, because these incidents, they happen, they take, you know, a few minutes and that's it. The police is not always around. So how can we create this cadre of people within society that we can screen and we can train and we can have them carry firearms in public? Well, that's going to cost us a lot of money as the Ministry of Public Safety or Public Security. Well, we can just rely on this ready-made solution. There's people out there that have the training, have the screening, have the ongoing qualifications going on, because sometimes they're in the reserves. We can allow them to carry a firearm in public. And that's what it's based on. So it's also, if you're a volunteer, I think, with the police for a few years, or if you're a medic, or if you're a firefighter, simply because you might be the first on scene, regardless of whether or not you're wearing the kind of so-called hat of a security person or a police person.
Right.
So you don't have where, like here, where any citizen can, as long as they're not prohibited by law because of past actions, they can go apply for a concealed permit. And for example, until that's ruined here for us too, here shortly, maybe.
Yeah, it doesn't exist.
Don't give them any ideas, Sean.
Nor is there such a thing as a concealed permit. If you are authorized, it's a little bit like a deputization, really, what it is. And if you ask people over there, they would call it a personal permit. But really what it is not a personal permit. It's a deputization, because the state authorizes you to purchase and carry one firearm, and the license that you get has the serial number of the firearm, so it's attached
specific
to your name. You can only own one firearm and 50 rounds. You can't buy more than 50 rounds, because you'll never need more than 50 rounds you can't really carry. Well, you can if you have 1,000 magazines, but really, how much can you carry? So it's very restricted.
And I think I remember when we were all talking, you know, just when we were having conversation a week and a half ago or something like that.
No, I'm sorry. They changed it to 100 rounds like a couple of months ago because of the situation.
Because of the
war. Used to be 50.
Okay.
Rounds, yeah.
But still, so like you were saying, under normal, not at war circumstances, just for security of the populace, those specific people have a personal permit, one gun, not two, one.
Right.
And you don't get 49 rounds, you don't get 51 rounds, you get 50 rounds.
Yeah, you buy one box, and that's what you have.
And so do they have you qualify, and then you use up those rounds, and if you use 25 rounds, they're going to give you 25 rounds to replenish, or they'll take them and say, okay, now we have accounted for 50 rounds, here's your new issued rounds for your firearm.
Let's not call that give you or issue, because you're buying them. The only thing is that you have a license for 50 or 100 rounds. That's your license, and you can go to the shooting range and shoot as much as you want.
Oh, okay.
But you can only leave there with the amount that you either shot or you brought in, or you can not bring anything and just leave your 50 rounds at home or so.
And then buy it there and shoot. As long as you don't leave with it, and in your possession, you have 50 rounds.
Right.
Wow. Per person that has that personal permit.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I guess one qualifier here, as I hear Dan explain it, is the fact that in most other countries out there, owning a firearm is not a God-given right like we have here in our Bill of Rights. So it's more like a privilege that is given or issued by the government, just like all of us here have a driver's license. We all have cars. We can buy cars. But our driver's licenses are a privilege.
Right.
The government issues them, and the government can take them away.
Right.
And that's because it's not God-given rights as part of the Bill of Rights.
Correct.
Yeah, driving
is not a constitutional right.
Right.
Whereas in other countries, they do not have the right to carry, own, possess, whatever, firearms as a right. So I think that's the huge distinction that we need to draw here. And I think that makes a huge difference.
But can I ask you a question? The constitutional right is not for firearms. It's for arms.
Correct.
What happens 30 years from now when everyone has a laser gun? That's not a firearm.
So I'm glad you bring that up. I've been asked that. And that is, so the affirmative defense, if you will, to that argument is for here, because we have the right to keep and bear arms. And it's not, it gets pointed to a lot, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. There's a comma there. A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And if you look back then, the American government taking on the largest army the world had ever seen, and somehow by the grace of God being able to win when less than 13% of the population on either side took part, whether they were, Tories or Patriots, as it was looked at, they had the same armaments or better than the government itself.
And so arms is capitalized in the Second Amendment as well.
Right. And, the joke I think Family Guy did, it was like, I think that's going to be pretty clear. Everyone has the right to a set of bear arms on their wall. And there's like bear arms coming that are mounted. But in all seriousness, it was, if you look at, for example, the privateers, they made up a large and actually majority at times of the Navy. It was privately held ships that were contracted as merchant marines or merchant soldiers to use their ships and levied in the common defense. And you had cannons, which even today you can own cannons. And, I remember, them saying, like, Joe Biden saying, well, you can't just have a cannon. Like, yes, you can. You
yes,
literally
you can.
It's a muzzle loader. It's not even a gun by law. I mean, you're not going to, go up to the bank and front stuff a cannon, like, give them full broadside, Mr. Higgins. But but if you look at it from that standpoint, and they've even said, repeating arms, they existed. You had, for example, the Puckle gun, which was mounted, and it was a multi-firing flintlock. And it outgunned what the soldiers had. So that's the argument, is like, even if it was laser guns, then the people should have laser guns, because that's what the common defense is of the day. So this whole argument where they're trying to, which is, everybody's hearing now what they're trying to do in this state, they're going to lose in court. It's going to get challenged. They're thumbing their nose at the Bruin decision that we just had from the Supreme Court. And they're saying, we're going to ban 90%+ of guns in Colorado. And that's what they're trying to do. That's how it's written right now. They're going to lose, and they know that. But they don't care, because they're still going to enact it and say, well, we did our part, and it'll limit our rights for however long it takes for it to go up to the Supreme Court and get shot down. But that's why we have AR-15s. But we don't have M-16s. So they're not saying that it's, we don't have Tomahawk missiles and nuclear bombs in our arsenals at home. But there is a certain bearing of arms as far as firearms goes, whether it's blades or guns. We should have the equivalent firepower, because the whole point is not for hunting and not for even defending from a home invasion. That's a given as your God-given right. Your home is your castle. It's to take on a tyrannical government.
And I'm going to inject one thing here. I told you that the arms is capitalized. And I think that our founding fathers kept the language vague enough to progress through time. And all of this stuff can also be found within the pages of the Federalist Papers that explains the Second Amendment and why it was put in to the Bill of Rights.
But then you take that, and this is where I'm forcing myself out of my comfort zone and looking at, so from the American perspective, as much as I'm like, I don't want any, like, nobody has any right to tell me that I can't. I don't care who it is. I don't care what they write on a piece of paper, because if I'm somewhere that has a no gun sign, the criminal's not like, oh, damn, and they leave. No, they're like, sweet, these people are not they're defenseless. And then you look at what happened even on October 7th, but I can't just look at that. It's too easy for me to take the American perspective, which is all I know, and be like, well, they should have had guns there. Well, culturally, that's not how it is there, right?
Well, one of the categories, in addition to what I was mentioning before, that was based more on the both the kind of the experience and the training and the qualification of the individual, there's a different category there, which is geographic. And along the borders of the country, because of it being mostly in a state of either war or kind of lower intensity conflict throughout its existence, there is a geographic category as well. And then some people who live along the border could also own the same thing, one handgun, and I guess, I don't know exactly, probably something like that. There's a different set of, there's a different category altogether that has to do more with rifle, like an actual military rifle, not like here.
So like an M16,
an actual M16 or M4, as it is now.
Yeah.
And there are these kind of readiness squads throughout the communities that are along the border, and these are voluntary. I mean, these are people who have regular civilian jobs, but
kind of like militia.
It is a well-regulated militia.
Well-regulated militia.
And so is the other thing that I was talking about. It is a well-regulated militia, right? The civilians that are qualified and trained and recertified and all that. So along the border, the communities have, and not all communities, but some communities have these readiness squads, and they, now I don't know exactly how it works in each one. It could be that they keep the rifle at home, or it could be that they have an armory like in the community, and if there's an emergency they can deploy those firearms. But these are people who have some experience and are willing to give up their time to train once in a while. And again, I don't know the details exactly, but it's sanctioned by the Ministry of Defense, but it might be also in some combination with the Ministry of Public Security or not, I don't know. But it's, they have communications, they have radio systems to talk to the authorities, and it's well-regulated and organized militia of people who are, that's completely voluntary. I mean,
and there's examples that we've heard, even in mainstream media, when the attacks happened on October 7th in Israel, is there are examples of those who are more ready that were in those squads, in those units, those well-regulated militia groups, that were able to fare better for their communities because they responded to the attackers and poured the fire back on them. And they did a little bit better in very, very small instances where most were taken by surprise and were innocent and defenseless.
Right.
And these people actually were able to stop and fire back in some of these cases, and they fared better, yes?
And in some cases, they managed to completely repel the attack altogether. Because tactically, they are familiar with their little village. They know where to take up positions. The opposing force, yes, it's true that there was preparation on the other side and there were maps of different villages and communities, but still, if there's a group of people who is ready and armed and equipped. And by the way, a lot of these communities are on the left side of the political spectrum. I mean,
they're in like communes, like hippies, kind
of,
right?
Not all of them, but some of them are. And it's not like the old kind of communes that existed before with the kibbutzes. But still, a lot of the people that lived in those areas were certainly more on the left-leaning side of the political spectrum. That does not mean, when they're ideologically speaking of a perfect world that they would like to see, even with the people from the other side of the border with the Palestinians. So, however peace-loving in ideology they were. Some of them still also thought that on a practical level they should be able to defend themselves until such time where this utopia arrives. Others didn't. There were communities there that did not have the ability to defend themselves. There were also, I'll tell you this because I think you would love this, and we talked about this just a little bit, but there's risk assessment that's done by the authorities all the time. And with some of these communities, the state came in and said, well, we're assessing your risk because relatively low. We need to take your guns back.
Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, here.
I don't know if they said okay or not. Yeah. I don't know exactly how it happened. Sure. I hope I'm not.
Yeah, that
I hope
wasn't.
I don't want to do a disservice to anyone, and I don't want to blame anyone. And if it didn't happen exactly the way I said, we're talking about it here, then I apologize in advance to anyone who's taking offense over there. But the truth of the matter is that the authorities, the insurance companies, the different corporations, the different types of entities and organizations that carry out different levels of risk assessment on a broad scale, using statistics and past incidents. Yes, in a broad scale, you might say, well, you know, this is low risk, so if it materializes, in air quotes, only a few people will die. And on a kind of a broad scale, maybe that's an acceptable risk. But for the person who's in that community who also dies, in the end, that's his 100%, his or her 100% of the risk.
Yeah, and they're having to, they are on a border that is, for lack of a better term, they're in a consistent state of war in one state or another, right, with whoever wants to harm them. Not that everybody does, but there's definitely enough that do. And you have these border areas where I can see why that even in a culture that's not looking at it as, I mean, unless you're a competitive shooter or hunting, which is, those are probably not super common like they are here. It's just not viewed as necessary. But when you're on these border areas, it's more necessary. So that's why those units existed, and some were able to fight back. And then you look at some of the areas where, correct me if I'm wrong here, I believe like where Israel's contending and repelling Hezbollah is in the north, right?
Yep.
And so if you look at these groups, whether it's Hamas or Hezbollah, and how they're viewed, where, you know, in Israel and here in the States, we're classifying them as terrorists. And yet that's not necessarily how it's looked at over there. And they have pretty free access to arms if they're in these groups, because they can be ready. That's their militia. Even if they're sending them on the offensive for whatever reason, that's why they're there. They can pull them up and send them out pretty quick because there are people that are in those units, correct? Then they have free access to guns in their homes. They have AKs, maybe not handguns so much.
No, not handguns so much, but mostly rifles.
And they're not viewed, you know, something that surprised me a lot is that they're not viewed, even though we look at them as a terrorist organization, and it's very black and white. It's like, no, they're a terrorist organization. That's obvious. Like, nobody can contest that. It's not necessarily how they're viewed there, even in their culture, where is it, Lebanon?
Yeah, as I mentioned, in Lebanon, you know, our government here considers Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. But within Lebanon itself, speaking with folks who are from Lebanon, Hezbollah is not considered a terrorist organization within Lebanon. As we spoke earlier in the last election, Hezbollah actually won the majority of the seats in the Lebanese parliament. So they have a military faction of their party, because Hezbollah actually means the party of God. So in Lebanon, Hezbollah runs as a party of God, is actually a legitimate political party. And they run in elections, they run elections themselves, they have observers, and they have officials who actually officially run to get the nomination of Hezbollah for parliament. So within Lebanon, they're just considered a political party, even though they have a military or paramilitary, whatever we want to call it, leg of their party, but they're the same way that Dan was explaining, that military leg is because they are bordering quote-unquote hostile enemies, and they are basically chartered to protect Lebanon and Lebanese citizens.
That's pretty remarkable. Just that all of that information to me is fascinating on its face, just because we in America here view all of that stuff as so different. You know, we picture robes and on AK-47, the back of a Toyota, truck zipping down the road and just all over the place, and women and children screaming and running, and you know, that's kind of how we view it over here. So
but
that's
they're elected in, right? And it's the same thing. Again, correct me if I'm wrong here, Dan, but Israel had a lot to do with letting the Palestinians choose their government, and they elected Hamas.
Yeah, I don't know how much they had to do with you know, the elections in Gaza, and also at what point was the last election in Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, once they took absolute power corrupts absolutely. Once they took over, but they were there, that is their government. So where we're looking at here is Hezbollah and here's Hamas. These are terrorist organizations that butcher the populace and are committing these atrocities. But when you look at it from a cultural standpoint with them, a lot of the time they're under their boot, of course. I mean, these people are getting tons of money from even the United States, tons. But the people aren't seeing it. It's being kept by Hamas, and they're keeping the money for themselves, and their people suffer. But they are the government in power over the populace, yes?
Well, this is where I'm not a very good radio personality, because I'd rather just talk about things I more or less know, almost from personal. And I really, you most likely are right, but you know about that, you know, more or less as much as I do. I mean, I don't know anything more than you. We can, however, ask ourselves, I think, very basic questions. One of the things I mentioned to you was, you know, you can just look at different, what would you call, you know, we talk about tyranny and we talk about the ability of the population to defend itself against tyranny. Which countries do you think today that you know of, if the public had firearms and access to firearms, which of the countries today, which populations of which countries having been afforded an equivalent of the Second Amendment would rise up against their government today, do you think? Give me an example, if you can think of.
I mean, the most prepared, which isn't saying a lot, because I think there's a romanticized version with people being frustrated about it here in the States. We are the most prepared, and that's not saying a lot, because I think a lot of people think of that and they don't think about logistically what it takes.
Yeah, but it's the Second Amendment already exists here.
Yes. So other countries, I would have said Canada, but now Trudeau's seen to that. They get one incident and it is like,
but they
done.
Have, they, you can buy a gun in Canada. Yeah, you need to go through a process, but it's not, unless you have a criminal background or like a psychiatric background.
Didn't Trudeau just change that, like within the last year or so? That you couldn't import, export, purchase, sell any kind of...
Yes, it's being more and more restricted. Yeah.
But even then, just to focus on your question, there aren't many. And even if they had it now, if we were to just go across the world and say, everybody has that basic human right to protect themselves, protect their communities, their families, to stand up to a government, if you even look at our country's history doing that, it... That was unheard of. It should not have happened. Us being able to take on Great Britain, we just had the, somehow with God's intervention or however you want to look at it, it is not something that's super simple that can be just done. Even if you said bippity boppity boop, everybody has a gun. We'll be right back. We're taking a quick break.
Frank Franktown Firearms is unlike any other gun store or range.
My name is Tony, and I'll tell you why I first started going to Franktown, because my children wanted me to get comfortable with firearms.
Franktown Firearms, it's not the kind of experience you get anywhere else.
I'm not familiar with firearms, and they just took their time and really gave me the time of day to know that I was an appreciated customer of theirs.
Tactical Fun Night is an absolute blast. To move and shoot, walk and reload and turn corners and hit moving targets.
I've been to ladies' nights a few times, and the range safety officers helped my friend who I brought who'd never fired a gun before. I felt very comfortable. I could just shoot to my comfort level. I didn't have to show up anybody, or no one was trying to show me up.
They let us go to the range and try the firearms before we bought them.
All of the staff there really took their time with me.
After going in there for the first time, we realized we didn't need to look at any other gun stores.
Franktown Firearms, where friends are made.
Welcome back, and howdy to those just joining us to Shooting the Breeze. So we were just talking with Dan and Alan and Karen.
Hi there.
Hi. And me.
I'm Hi, Sean. Guys.
Hi. Dan had brought up right before the break. Dan, would you mind repeating your question that you were just kind of putting out there for us to consider?
Yeah, because we started this, you know, half an hour ago. We were talking about the Second Amendment and, you know, how it is different in different places in terms of gun ownership. So I'm reversing the question. I'm asking, which country do you think today, having been afforded this unique right that exists in this country, Second Amendment, which, and since we talk about the Second Amendment in the context of being able to resist tyranny and not necessarily home defense,
right,
which country do you think today would benefit the most and people would actually revolt against their government anywhere in the world? And let me just say one more thing. You said just before the break, you know, it's not that easy to go up against the government, but our history is full of revolutions. Revolutions, I mean,
sure.
It's all, and 1979 and so on. So, which, I mean, think of the dictatorships that exist today. Think of the people that feel that they're oppressed. Think of of groups within societies. Don't necessarily limit yourself to, when I say country, don't limit your thinking to an internationally recognized border. What about women? What about women in some countries? They're half of the population. Would they revolt against the regime that's oppressing them? What do you think about that?
That's a very good question. And I actually was thinking that, like, as you were talking, I was kind of delineating in my mind more, like, who's more oppressed. And that, I mean, it's hard to say because here, and I think that women here in the States and in Western cultures, they have freedom, but it wasn't even that long ago that women couldn't vote. Like in the 1930s, they got the right to vote. So it's not like, it's like, oh, well, we're this bastion on the hill for hundreds of years. No, it was part of that experiment. But over in the majority of the world, women do not have those rights. And right now we're all heated with, you know, there's the feminism and all that. And it's like, but then I always think, like, why are we even focused on that? There's so many that don't have that. So it's a good question. You would focus. I would say if we did, what I was saying before the break, if you just waved your magic wand and said everybody has a Second Amendment right, boop, there's a gun in the hands of everybody that wants them. And even then, it would be interesting to see, because it takes a lot to stand up to that tyranny.
I have a strange answer.
So
that
I
think you'll all agree with me. Are you being a smart aleck?
No, I also have an answer I wanted to give.
Okay. Put Trump back in office and watch Antifa and groups like BLM, watch them rise up and revolt.
Yeah. You mean with mostly peaceful protests?
Of course.
Right.
My
answer,
I was going to say France, I think. I think if France had more access to
That's
firearms.
That's a good point.
France has always been a country of, you know, revolution and revolt and rising up. They raised the retirement age by 2 years, and they're bringing guillotines out of the public offices, front doors. I think if you give them guns, I think they'd do something.
Well, and you can have guns in France. That's, I mean, it's really restricted, but not as much as other European nations.
Right. Farmers, ranchers, truckers.
Well, I would say, out of the 197 countries out there, probably a good 99.9% of them would rise up. Because in most of, when you look at where the majority of the countries are and the landmass is, you know, Eurasia. Asia and Europe are connected by land. And most of the population on Earth actually lives in that zone. And so, and historically, going back to 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years ago, that culture across the entire region is very tribal. A lot of people have allegiance to their tribes first, you know, and that most of the political borders, I mean, you know, the border between Iran and Iraq, or between Syria and Turkey, and, you know, there are tribes that actually, for example, the Kurds, they live geographically in the same area that culminates southern Turkey, eastern Syria and northern Iraq and western Iran. So they're all one tribe. They're all one religion. They have one culture. But they're, you know, everybody has cousins who are, by, I guess, designation of theoretical borders or border lines across from Turkey to Syria. I mean, people live in Syria and they have relatives, brothers, sisters in Turkey.
In
the Turkish region. Or people live in Syria and they have brothers, sisters, cousins in Iraq. Or people, you know, Kurds in Iraq have. So for most parts, the regulations that control those quote-unquote borders don't exist for that particular tribe. I mean, you know, they have been struggling to get their independence from all these four countries who have somehow stepped in and said, oh, from here to here is mine, from there to there is belongs to Iraq, and from there to there is in Syria, and now you cross that mountain and you're in Turkey. Yeah. So, you know, the tribal nature of that whole area makes it very difficult for regulations. I mean, you know, guns are, I guess, gun ownership may be quote unquote illegal in Iran, in Iraq. Well, maybe not so much in Iraq right now, not so much in Syria, but definitely in Iran and in Turkey. But most of those Kurds are armed.
Yeah, because they're I see what you're saying. It's almost like, kind of, if you picture here and you have four corners and four states, even though we're united as states, each state is individual.
Correct.
And even after fighting a civil war in this country, it's still, and today, it's just as hot button as it was then, and it's rising up again. And
maybe even hotter.
Yeah, what do these states have rights to do? And then you have, in the states, look at Denver and Boulder, and you have a more blue, and the capital there, and us as conservatives are not represented well. But then you look at the rest of the state, which is red and rural, and you have more people like that. So it's hard, and I'm picturing what you're saying with the Kurds, is that they have, you know, they're looking like, wait a minute, like, yeah, you're in this imaginary border, but I don't care about that because you're in my tribe and you're my blood, my kin.
Correct.
So they're like, here's a Kalashnikov. Just go put it in your closet and don't talk about it.
Correct.
And so that's an interesting way to look at it. You know, the imaginary borders aren't as important to the average person who's familial lines or tribal lines or allegiances lie with those they are like-minded with.
Correct.
Yeah. And what do you think on that, Dan?
Well, I think that we're talking about, we're going a little bit back to gun ownership and the different laws and whether or not they're adhered to or not. But think about this. We're asking ourselves which political entities, let's call them, what we know today as countries, which political entities and subdivisions, right? Subdivisions of those political entities, because we have different gun laws even between states. Maybe. Depends on whether or not it goes up all the way up to the Supreme Court or not, and it's challenged or not. But there are differences, significant differences across the world between societies and their access to firearms, lawful access to firearms. So some countries' populations are armed, and some, or at least are, have the right to be armed, and some countries' populations completely not. But interestingly, 100% of the governments are armed.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so, historically speaking, that doesn't usually work out in the end for everybody else.
That's right. So 100% of the governments are armed, not 100% of the subjects or the populations are armed.
Well, that's just like the 100% of the really, really popular celebrities live in gated, gated communities with armed guards, and all of them squawk about guns and take away the guns and ban assault weapons and
rules for thee and not for me.
Exactly. Two-tiered justice.
Yep. And that's an interesting thing to consider, because I've always been fascinated at that with just human beings as in general. Like, we are so complex, but we're also so predictable. And the second someone gets enough power, it's very rare that they want to let that go, and they're going to consolidate it. Absolute power corrupts, absolutely. We are watching it in this country right now. And something I found interesting, I do not know his name, but after the war kicked off and Israel started taking everybody else to task, they're like, oh, no, we're responding to this. And I respect them for that. Even if I don't agree with everything, which is hard for me to say if I agree or not, because we're not getting the whole story. I know that much. And it's influenced. And so, but I am looking at it as they had, I think it was MSNBC. It was one of the more left, if you want to say, quote unquote, you can't see me doing air quotes, but I'm doing them, everybody, is left-leaning liberal media, whatever you want to say. I want to say it that way. And they had, I think it was MSNBC, and they had an official from Israel on there. And they're just like assuming, they're like, oh, well, you're left like us. So they're like saying, oh, this is ridiculous, and Israel's, this and that, and they're taking it too far. And he goes, and they're saying, I'm sure your party's fighting back with the conservatives. He goes, stop. No. And he looks at them like they're stupid. He goes, we are very united in cause. We just had our people attacked, and it doesn't matter left or right. Everybody agrees something has to be done, and we need them to stay out of our country, because if we don't do something, we're just going to have more shootings, more attacks. And that I found interesting, where here, we will fall on the sword, and I've watched this. You have a 20-25%, Richard that we had on. That's he's the minority whip in the state house right now, and he's trying to reach across party lines because that's all he can do. And watching as 20-25% of the Democrats who are really, like, rabidly anti-Israel, and the rest of them are just towing the line, when it's like, this is wrong. We should support Israel. This is wrong. And they're like, nope. And of course, I'm making it seem simpler than it is. It's obviously extremely complicated over there. And us sitting all the way over here, when normally we're like, oh, that sucks. That's going on across the sea. That's too bad. And then we go like, oh, what's on TV? What's on Netflix?
And that's really interesting that you bring that up. And Ellen, I wanted to speak just for a second to something that you said about tribalism. Mm-hmm. So I think that, how we always talk about the United States and the people here being so divided. And we have been for quite a while. Yeah. I'm going to just say back to Obama, maybe, is when the major divisions kind of started to happen.
Yeah.
So I think that we're pretty tribalistic as well, but our tribes are much, much, much smaller, and some of them are much, much weaker. Like, you have the BLMs and the Antifas, and then you have your, you know, your soccer moms, and then you have people like me, women, gun owners, and then you have all these little tiny sections, and divided we can't stand, right?
Right. And they're obviously, when I say they, government is obviously afraid, because they are trying to pass bills right now that if more than four people get together and train with guns, that they want to make that illegal, because you're training as a militia. It's like, there's a lot of militias. And if you're going to construe getting together and shooting guns as a militia meeting, that tells me that there's fear. And that's good. They should be afraid.
The government should
absolutely fear the people, because they work for us. And it's not left and right. At the end of the day, they're clinking their scotch glasses. At the end of the day, those who are in the highest positions of power, it's not left and right. It's us versus them. And all of us, with fringes of extremism on either side of the aisle, we really are a uniparty. And we have all of us, the majority, in the middle, wherever we lie, but we're all in it together, whether we want to agree with it or not. And that is extremely interesting. And the founding fathers, they expected a revolution to happen every 100 years. Like, they knew what would happen, and they tried to frame it and leave it to be a little vague, like you were saying, Karen, because they knew the people will have to put the government in check.
Well, but we're about 175 years late, so.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting. But then you look at it culturally, like Luke pointed out with France, and that's the first thing that popped in my mind is, you know, they looked at us back when we had our revolution against Great Britain, and then they had a revolution, and they came expecting America to back them up. And you have George Washington be like, no, we're not doing that. We can't survive another one. We just got out of war. And they're like, wait a minute. We backed you up. And he's like, I support you, but we don't have the money and we don't have the arms. We just barely made it. And we're just like hemorrhaging on the floor right now. We got to put this country together. So then they carried on and did their own. And you have a cultural difference even now, whether it's tribalistic or you just look at it from a government standpoint. And what Dan was saying, you know, putting forward that question of, you know, what if, like, what would happen? And that's extremely interesting to think of, because I think we would see very different things happen across very different regions based on the culture.
I have another question for you.
Great.
I love it when the guests ask the questions. That's awesome.
I love that. That's what I like about Dan. Yeah.
Tribalism exists everywhere to different degrees.
Yeah.
And you can find yourself relating to someone on a personal level, obviously. I mean, what I'm saying now is both clear, but still has to be. Who said it? Even the self-evident has to be restated. Sometimes I forget whose quote that was, but you can find yourself really relating to someone who is not geographically your neighbor. Could be from a different country completely, maybe even the other side of the world. But you find a lot of you really share a lot of the, like, regular values. So what about if we talk about tribalism, not delineating ourselves along familial lines, but simple values? I'll give you an example.
Ideological lines?
Not even ideological. Even simpler. For example, I lived in places in the world where traffic laws are really ignored by some very large parts of the population. So do we think that there's a reason for traffic laws? Is it a good idea that everyone stops in a red light or not? You take it for granted in most of the Western world that people simply abide by traffic laws because they know that, yeah, they don't want to stop for the red light. There's no one there. It's the middle of the night. But they still do it because we live in society and we don't live individually only on our own, except you at your ranch. but is that giving up some liberty? Yes, because at that point, society is asking you not to drive, to stop your car and wait, even though it makes no sense because it's 3 a.m. and there's no one around. But that's a simple question. So I'm taking you back to the women's rights. Your sister, your daughter, your mom, your grandmother. If you were able to choose where you can let them, like, you know, you're asking yourself, where would you want your female relatives or friends to live
in the U.S., in Sweden, in somewhere in Africa, somewhere in the Middle East.
The U.K.
In the U.K.
Not
would
anymore
you feel,
the U.K., no. Yeah, here.
Well, I mean, that's, I think, forget about, you know, we talk about this a lot when I tell you, just set aside politics and geopolitics for a minute and experience this from your own, as close to home as possible, your own family, the people that you know, your own experiences.
And you're going to answer that, though, based on
too
your
long a
biases.
Question. My question
you
is
know.
Too long.
But
you ahead. Would answer that based on your biases and what you believe to be true about the UK and Sweden and, you know, Canada or the Middle East or whatever.
Oh, and there's going to be better and worse. When you're asking me that, immediately, just being brutally honest, the first thing I think of is my two daughters, my little girls, who are the apple of my eye, who I bought a pony for because I made them cry. And, you know, I want them to have the most opportunities and to be safe, and any man that would end up with them, if I have anything to do with it, is going to treat them with that respect, where even though I have a lot more traditional values in my household and family, my wife is very supportive of me, and we have our, you know, our positions in the home, I would have them here because that is the best possible chance for opportunity for them as an individual, as a woman who is an individual, to have the least amount of flack around them as they try to navigate through the air, so to speak.
So let me put a caveat in there. Not that I want to, you know, we're having a discussion here, but I don't think that question, the way posed, is fair in the sense of getting that question answered and then projecting that answer across the world. Because Sean is not a typical world citizen. A typical world citizen of the 7 billion people, how many have had the chances that you and I had to be, to live in different cultures for so long and learn about the do's and the don'ts of those various regions? And I don't want to call it countries, because in some of the countries I have lived, the culture varies from region to region. So it's not a fair question to ask someone with the knowledge that Sean has, with the rights and the familiarity what's available here in the United States to people and what rights they have. Whereas 90% of the population who lives around the world does not know any better.
Right. So, you know, that's my point.
90% of the people who live in the Middle East, they don't even have a sixth grade education. 90% of them, they go to the mosque and talk to the imam, and they believe that the imam is the representative of God. And the imam says, oh, if a child, for example, I'm making this up, so I don't want to offend anybody out there. If a child pisses on your rug, you have to cut that area out and leave your rug with a hole in the middle of it. And they will go home and do it, because they believe that statement is coming from the representative of God.
So would you say...
So if you ask those people, those are the people who might, and I say this not particularly for a particular religion or anything, from personal experience, that those are the people who actually sit around the table, like guys like you and me, and they decide that your son is going to eventually, somewhere down the road, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, would marry my daughter. This would be a contract between you and me, and then your son would have to carry it out, and my daughter would have to carry out my words to you. And so from that perspective, if you ask the same question to 10 different people from 10 different regions, you would get 10 different answers that are going to be much farther away from what Sean just gave you, because that is the very definition of tribalism and the regional culture that is governing the minds and the thoughts and the hearts of those people in each region.
And that's the biases.
And I appreciate what you're saying, because what I'm thinking is, as you're saying that, is that is, if you take us back to like my Anglo-Saxon, my European ancestral roots, if you go back to the medieval era, and during the Dark Ages, you had very much that. People couldn't read unless you were part of the church, and you would go to the church, which was the Catholic Church, and they would say, the Pope says this, and this is what I'm telling you, and you'd say, okay, that's exactly what I'm going to do, because that's what the representative of God said, so I'm going to do it.
And or if you had the plague,
that's what
John,
the beauty of John Locke. His major writing was about the separation of the monarchy from God.
Yeah,
and I know we're coming up on time.
But then I want to go back to your first question about if everyone had a Second Amendment. If you ask those 10 people from 10 different places, of course, with me and my daughters, I know I want the best for them individually. So of course I'm going to pick here.
Of course.
A lot of them don't know.
But listen to this, what I just said. So in a hypothetical situation that I introduced, where me and Dan sit around the table and make a contract with each other, I would have the best interest of my daughter in mind
when I
make that contract with Dan, that my daughter will, when she turns 18, 15, whatever, would marry his son, because I have the best interest of my daughter.
Of course.
But my biases and my mindset is influenced by tribal, religious, regional culture that I do not, you know, that I was born into, and I'm not privy to anything else, any other option. You know, if I had a chance to go to college and be familiar with the Western culture and potentially live in the United States, then I would have the same answer as you do, that, hey, I'm not going to make this contract, but sorry.
So now, we're of course running out of time here. We're out.
Fastest hour in broadcasting right here.
Yeah, always. But it does make me think, I wish I could do a simulation and just pass out guns to all the different cultures and see what they do and decide. Because that individual liberty, I think, is something that if afforded the opportunity, most are going to pick, but not necessarily in the ways I would think. And so it's all very interesting. Thank you all for listening to us. Dan and Alan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yep, thanks.
And you can reach us at franktownfirearms.com. We're open 7 days a week. Thank you all for listening, and God bless.
Thank you for listening to Shooting the Breeze, brought to you by the team at Franktown Firearms. Mention that you heard Shooting the Breeze on KLZ when you purchase a gun, and Franktown Firearms will waive your background fee. Veterans, first responders, and law enforcement receive a Patriot discount on everything in the store. Get in touch with Franktown Firearms now at klzradio.com/guns. Franktown Firearms, where friends are made.